Mark was carried along by the fanatical energy of Fergus MacDonald and Helena. Fergus was the comrade who had shared with him experience that most men never knew, the stark and terrible involvement of combat. He was also much older than Mark, a paternal figure, filling a deep need in his life. It was easy to suspend the critical faculties and believe, not to think, but to follow blindly wherever Fergus's bitter, restless energy led them. There was excitement and a sense of commitment in those meetings with men like him, men with an ideal and a sense of destiny. The secret meetings in locked rooms with armed guards at the doors, the atmosphere quivering with the promise of forbidden things, the cigarette smoke spiralling upwards until it filled the room with a thick blue haze, like incense burning at some mystic rite, the faces shining with sweat and quiet frenzy of the fanatic as they listened to the speakers. Harry Fisher, the chairman of the party, was a tall, fierce man with a heavy gut, the brawny shoulders and hairy, muscular arms of a boilermaker, an unkempt shock of coarse, wiry black hair laced with strands of silver and dark, burning eyes. "We are the party, the Praetorian Guard of the proletariat, and we are not bound by law or the ethical considerations of the bourgeois age. The party in itself is the new law, the natural law of existence." Afterwards he shook hands with Mark, while Fergus stood by with paternal pride. Fisher's grip was as fierce as his stare. "You're a soldier," he nodded. "We will need you again, comrade. There is bloody work ahead." The disquieting presence of the man stayed to haunt Mark long afterwards, even when they rode home in the crowded tramcar. The three of them squeezed into a double seat so that Helena's thigh was pressed hard against his. When she spoke to him, she leaned sideways, her lips almost touching his cheek, and her breath smelling of licorice and cigarettes, a smell that mingled with the cheap flowery perfume she wore and the underlying musky warmth of her woman's body. There were other meetings on the Friday evenings, great raucous shouting gatherings where hundreds of white miners crowded into the huge Fordsburg Trades Union Hall, most of them boozy with cheap brandy, loud and inarticulate and spoiling for trouble. They roared like the crowd at a bullfight as the speakers harangued them. Occasionally one of the audience climbed onto his chair to sway there, shouting meaningless, confused slogans until his laughing comrades dragged him down. One of the most popular speakers at these public meetings was Fergus MacDonald. He had a dozen tricks to excite his audience. He probed their secret fears and twisted the probe until they howled half in pain and half in adulation. "You know what they're planning, the bosses? You know what they're going to do? First they will fragment the trades," a thunderous, ugly roar that shook the windows in their frames. And Fergus paused on the stage, sweeping his sparse sandy hair back off his forehead and grinning down at them with his thin, bitter mouth until the sound subsided. "The trade that took you 5 years to learn, they'll split it up, and now there'll be three unskilled men to do your job, with only a year's training to learn that fragment, and they'll pay them a tenth of the wage you draw." A storming roar of, "No, no!" And Fergus flung it back at them. "Yes," he shouted, "yes, yes, and yes again. That is what the bosses are going to do. And that's not all. They're going to use blacks in your jobs. Black men are going to take those jobs away from you. Black men who will work for a wage that you cannot live on." They screamed now, frantic with anger, a terrible anger which had no object on which to focus. "What about your kids? Are you going to feed them on mealies? Are your wives going to wear limbo? That's what'll happen when the blacks take your jobs." "No," they roared, "no." "Workers of the world," Fergus shouted at them. "Workers of the world, unite and keep our country white." The bellow of applause, the rhythmic stamp of feet on the wooden floor, lasted for 10 minutes, while Fergus strutted back and forth across the stage, clasping his hands above his head like a prize fighter. When at last the cheering faltered, he flung back his head and bellowed the opening line of the red flag. The entire hall came crashing to its feet and stood at attention to sing the revolutionary song. "Then raise the scarlet standard high. Within its shade we'll live or die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here." Mark walked home with the MacDonalds in the frosty night, their breathing smoking like ostrich plumes in the lights of the street lamps. Helena walked between the men, a small, dainty figure in her black overcoat, with rabbit fur collar and a knitted cap pulled down over her head. She had slipped a hand into the crook of the elbows of each of them, a seemingly natural, impartial gesture, but there was a disturbing pressure of fingers on the hard muscle of Mark's upper arm, and her hip touched his as she skipped occasionally to catch the longer stride of the men. "Listen, Fergus, what you were saying there in the hall doesn't make sense, you know," Mark broke the silence, as they turned into the home street. "You can't have it both ways, workers unite and keep it white." Fergus chuckled appreciatively. "You're a bright one, lad, Comrade Mark. But I'm serious, Fergus. It's not the way Harry Fisher. Course not, lad. Tonight I was shovelling up swill for the hogs. We need them fighting mad. We have things to tear down, bloody work to do." He stopped and turned to face Mark over the woman's head. "We need cannon fodder, lad, and plenty of it." "So it won't be like that?" Mark asked. "No, lad, it'll be a beautiful, brave new world. All men equal, all men happy, no bosses, a worker's state." Mark tried to control his pricking, nagging doubts. "You keep talking of fighting, Fergus. Do you mean that? Literally, I mean. Will it be a shooting war?" "A shooting war, comrade, a bloody shooting war, just like the revolution in Russia, where Comrade Lenin has shown us the way. We have to burn away the dross. We have to soak this earth with the blood of the rulers and the bosses. We have to flood it with the blood of their minions, the petty bourgeois officers' class of the police and military." "What will..." Mark almost said "we," but it would not come to his lips. He could not make that commitment. "What will you fight with?" Fergus chuckled again and winked slyly. "Mum's the word, lad, but it's time you knew a little more." He nodded. "Yes, tomorrow night," he decided. On Saturday, there was a bazaar being held in the Trades Hall, a women's union fundraising drive for building the new church. Where the crazed mob had screamed murder and bloody revolution the previous night, now there were long trestle tables set out, and the women hovered over their displays of baked and fancily iced cakes, trays of tarts, preserved fruit in jars and jams. Mark bought a packet of tarts for a penny, and he and Fergus munched them as they wandered idly down the hall, stopping at the piles of second-hand clothing, while Fergus tried a maroon cardigan, and after careful deliberation purchased it for half a crown. They reached the top of the hall and stood beneath the raised stage. Fergus surveyed the room casually and then took Mark's arm and led him up the steps. They crossed the stage quietly and went in through a door in the wings into a maze of small union offices and storerooms, all deserted now on a Saturday afternoon. Fergus used a key from his watch chain to unlock a low iron door, and they stooped through it. Fergus re-locked behind him, and they went down a narrow flight of steps that descended steeply. There was a smell of damp and earth, and Mark realized that they were descending to the cellars. Fergus tapped on the door at the bottom of the stairs, and after a moment a single eye regarded them balefully through a peephole. "All right, comrade, Fergus MacDonald, a committee member." There was the rattle of chains, and the door opened. A disgruntled, roughly dressed man stood aside for them. He was unshaven and sullen, and against the wall of the tiny room was a table and chair, still spread with the remains of a meal and the crumpled daily newspaper. The man grunted, and Fergus led Mark across the room and through another door into the cellars. The floor was earthen, and the arched columns were in raw, unplastered brick. There was the stench of dust and rats, stale, dank air in confined space. A single bulb lit the centre starkly, but left the alcoves behind the arches in shadow. "Here, lad, this is what we're going to use." There were wooden cases stacked neatly to the height of a man's head in the alcoves, and the stacks were draped with heavy tarpaulin, obviously stolen from the railway yards, for they were stencilled S.A.R. and H., South African Railways and Harbours. Fergus lifted the edge of one tarpaulin and grinned that thin, humourless smile. "Still in the grease, lad." The wooden cases were branded with the distinctive arrowhead and WD of the British War Department, and below that the inscription, "Six pieces, Lee Enfield, Mark IV, CNVD. Mark was stunned. Good God, Fergus, there are hundreds of them. That's it, lad. And this is only one arsenal. There are others all along the rand. He lifted another tarpaulin, walking on down the length of the cellar. The ammunition cases with the quick-release catches on the detachable lids that were painted, 1,000 rounds, .303. We have enough to do the job. Fergus squeezed Mark's arm and led him on. There were racks of rifles now, ready for instant use, blued steel glistening with gun oil in the electric light. Fergus picked out a single rifle and handed it to Mark. This one's got your name on it. Mark took the weapon, and the feel of it in his hands was terribly familiar. It's the only one we've got, but the moment I saw it, I thought of you. When the time comes, you'll be using it. The P-14 sniper's rifle had that special balance that felt just right in his hands, but made Mark sick in the stomach. He handed it back to Fergus without a word, but the older man winked at him before racking it again carefully. Like a showman, Fergus had kept the best for last. With a flourish, he whipped the canvas off the heavy weapon, with its thick, corrugated, water-jacketed barrel, that squatted on its steel tripod. The Maxim machine gun, in its various forms, had the dubious distinction of having killed more human beings than any other single weapon that man's destructive genius had been able to devise. This was one of that deadly family, the Vickers Maxim .303 Mark IV B, and there were boxes stacked beside it, each containing a belt of 250 rounds. The gun could throw those at 2,440 feet per second and at a cyclic rate of 750 rounds a minute. How about that, comrade? You asked what we were going to fight with. How will that do for a beginning? In the silence, Mark could hear faintly but distinctly the sound of children's laughter from the hall above them. Mark sat alone upon the highest crest of the low kopjes that stretched into the west, black ironstone ridges breaking out of the flat, dry earth like the crested back of a crocodile surfacing from still lake water. The memory of the hidden arsenal had stayed with him through the night, keeping him from sleep, so that now his eyes felt gritty and his skin stretched tight and dry across the bones of his cheeks. Lack of sleep had left him with that remote feeling, a lightness of thought detached from reality, so now he sat in the bright sunlight, blinking like a day-flying owl, and looking like a stranger into his own mind. He felt a rising sense of dismay as he realized how idly he had drifted along the path that had brought him here to this very brink of the abyss. It had taken the feel of the P-14 in his hands and the laughter of children to bring him up at the end of a rope. All his training, all his deepest beliefs were centred on the sanctity of law, on the order and responsibilities of society. He had fought for that, had spent all of his adult life fighting for that belief. Now suddenly he had drifted, out of apathy, to the camp of the enemy. Already he was numbered with the legions of the lawless. Already they were arming him to begin the work of destruction. There was no question now that it was merely empty rhetoric, shouted at gatherings of drunken labourers. He had seen the guns. It would be cruel and without mercy. He knew Harry Fisher, had recognized the forces that drove him. He knew Fergus MacDonald. The man had killed before and often. He would not flick an eyelid when he killed again. Mark groaned aloud, aghast at what he had let happen to himself. He who knew what war really was, he who had worn the king's uniform and won his medal for courage. He felt the oily warmth of shame in his throat. A gagging sensation. And to arm himself against future weakness of this same kind, he tried to find the reasons why he had been drawn in. He realized now that he had been lost and alone, without family or home, and Fergus MacDonald had been the only shelter in the cold. Fergus, the older comrade of shared dangers, whom he had trusted without question. Fergus, the father figure. And he had followed again, grateful for the guidance, not questioning the destination.